You're listening to Fakeologist Audio Chat. This is a new and exciting way to communicate with fellow fakeologists from all over the world. Each day we compress and post the day's audio into a file that can be big or small. Discover new voices and ideas that talk about media fakery like you never did before. Please search for Fakeologist Audio Chat and Fakeologist Main Show on your favorite podcast app. To connect to our always on and always streaming audio chat, go to fakeologist.com/audio chat. To listen to the live stream, go to fake11.com/radio2. Now, on with the audio chat.
Hey, Frank. Mihal.
I'm trying to get a...
There you are. I hear you now. A voice of salt has emerged.
How are you, Ed?
I'm feeling well today. How are you, sir?
I'm also feeling very, very well, thank you.
That's very, very good. And
Are you cruising the streets, are you?
Yes. Yes, I am. I'm on the Queens Highway right now, just in case you needed reminding of where you lived and who owned the place. I'm on. It's got her name all over it.
As I was listening to you and Living Man chat, I was nodding fiercely like one of those dogs you have in your car.
That's great. Even if you were disagreeing, it would still be worth listening to. Disagreement is also important.
I was not disagreeing. I was nodding, just nodding.
Well, as long as you weren't nodding off.
No, it was great. It was really a terrific discussion.
Oh, thank you. A Living Man has got a lot to the table. He should do his own show because he gets drowned out by Rick and Rolo, which is fine. Sometimes too many people on a call is difficult.
There's too many chiefs and not enough Indians around this place.
Yeah. So what's on your mind this morning or this afternoon or this evening?
Look, nothing real. I mean, I've just been listening to your podcast, finding it very interesting. I find it very soothing, to be honest.
I know. You're so complimentary. I just hope I can continue to live
There's nothing to live up to. I just what do I think? I think I just think that the approach that I've distilled from this way of thinking is proving very helpful to me. So my life is...
Oh, good.
...is very satisfactory.
Well, as many people don't seem to know that listen to this podcast, I do have a blog and a video platform that are equally helpful in your understanding of this world. And yeah. It's
yes,
not...
You do.
Just me on the blog and on the videos. As a matter of fact, it's mostly not me. So I bring to you and the world many voices that are equally soothing and explaining of what's going on. And I go to them for my own comfort and soothing, and I share it with everyone else so they can see if it helps them as well. Like just listening this week, like this week's discovery that I pretty much exhausted his small library that's online was Dr. Michael S. Kaufman, who was a forestry engineer or doctor of, and he understood the eco-fascist dictatorship that was coming 25 years ago, and he did many public talks about it. in a very interesting way. And sadly, he's dead now. It looks like he timed out from this realm just by age and inflammation. And not enough people that talk like him out there anywhere, which I find stunning, because this is not a secret plan. It's been out in the open for 30 years. Is it just that people don't want to read the 40 sections of the Agenda 21 plan? Is that what the problem is? Or they're all happy with it? But the way he laid it out, and one of my favorite things I extracted from some of his talk was the eco-fascists think that everything on Earth is equal, including rocks. So, you know, when you deal with people that think like that, it's really, really
fascinating. I guess the slight difference between the way I frame those things is I don't for one second think that those people think like that.
Oh.
I just assume they are being very cynical. They essentially know what they're doing. They're using the rhetoric to get what they want. And it's got nothing to do with their personal views at all. For example, we know that they are happy to buy houses on beaches and so on.
Yeah.
There's not this. I don't think there is any way you can say that Al Gore demonstrates or walks the talk.
Yeah.
He has multiple houses. Apparently, his power bill is $70,000 or $80,000 a year for his home. And, you know, he flies around every $70,000 or $80,000 per year to
pay. Oh, $80,000. Wow. Yeah.
You know, these are the kind of everything is totally cynical in their in the actions of these people. They just don't care. So I don't. When you say to me things like, you know, that they believe this and they I don't have the view that they have any such beliefs at all.
Beliefs, yeah.
It is stupid.
That's true. And it's an act.
Yeah, it's a very cynical act. It doesn't really stand scrutiny in any way, shape, or form. And then when you point these things out to people that are, say, supporters of Al Gore, they just, but he's fighting the fight, so he's got to, you know, they'll make all sorts of excuses for the guy. And just completely, I just don't understand. They're totally mesmerized.
Well, you don't understand because the people don't understand. They don't understand what they're even being told.
Yeah.
They don't understand what is happening. It's a control mechanism to enslave and impoverish.
I had a fellow come and visit me yesterday, specifically because of the things I say about prayer and that the world is flat and so on, because he is a Christian, a strong Christian. But when he hears me talking about the earth being flat, he says that he thinks that's crazy and it's damaging the Christian movement. And he wanted to come and talk to me about it. And see if I was being genuine in my views or not. And I said to him, "Well, you tell me first. Do you think the Bible is true in every word?" And he said, "Yes, I think the Bible is true in every word." And so we said, "Okay, well, let's start from page one of Genesis and go through it." And before we'd got down three paragraphs, he was already saying, "Oh, it's a metaphor," or, you know, "Oh, you know, that bit's not true because, you know, we've moved on. We know more things now." So it's very interesting that people cannot even recognize their own thinking contradictions. You know, he doesn't believe that there's a firmament over the head, as it says in the Bible. Regardless of whether there is or there isn't, the point remains that he is holding a set of contradictory views, and that's a common place now, you know, just a common situation.
Yeah, it's cognitive dissonance.
Yeah.
Well, holding opposing views and trying to reconcile them.
But they do reconcile them. And they honestly, you know, he honestly said, I believe the Bible is literally true in every way, but we couldn't even get past the first three paragraphs before he acknowledged that he didn't think that was true.
Yeah. So his statement that he believes the Bible in every way is a lie. He doesn't.
It's just complete self-deception. And that's just the Bible. Who knows what goes on with people? The other one is people say that they all think the politicians lie, but every word that comes from their mouths they accept as being true. You know, for example, get your vaccination.
Yeah, exactly. Why do you listen to them if they lie?
Nothing is making any sense. So that is the continuing puzzle for me. But nothing that happened in this conversation yesterday suggested that I should alter the way that I approach my life. Let me put it that way. And that has come about really from the discussions on this forum and a few other forums, I guess, but largely this forum.
That's cool. Did the guy get in your house?
He didn't get in my house. I know him. He's the brother of a friend of mine, and he wanted to come and talk to me about it. And I welcomed him to come down. Come and let's chat. I took him to the pub, and we talked about it over a beer.
This guy has welcomed the vaccine into his skin.
Absolutely.
Taken the holy sacrament of Pfizer?
Yep.
Is he clotting up as we speak?
I don't know. He seems okay.
Good.
But you know, it's I guess the other thing, well, you've introduced me to the terrain theory through what you've been talking about.
Yeah.
Although for a long time, long before I got involved in any kind of skepticism, I haven't been taking vaccines for a long time. You know, even when I was a normie and someone was telling me to take the flu vaccine, when I looked up the statistics for deaths by flu in Australia in 2005, only 50 people per year were dying of the flu in Australia in 2005. Now, after all the vaccinations, there are 1,500 a year dying from it. It's just bonkers again.
Yeah, we know all this.
Yeah.
The numbers are pouring in from around the world now.
Well, I'm now just talking about the introduction of flu vaccines into Australia, which probably took place in earnest in about 2005. When they used to come around to workplaces, and I was in a workplace that was offering and recommending flu vaccines. Now, has anyone ever followed up whether those vaccines were effective? Where's the evidence-based medicine system they talk about? Just doesn't exist.
Yeah, they don't need evidence. I was going to post a video. I forgot to do it because I get so busy, of Harry Vox, who was a New Yorker, and he was showing that the head of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, who is a real Khazarian ghoul.
Yeah.
They donated an unspecified amount of money to the New York City Police Foundation, and he's being feted for that donation. And it really is stunning, the conflict of interest. Here we have a leader of a corporation that's knowingly poisoning people, and they're literally buying the police force's favors. So there's no chance that Pfizer, which I think's worldwide headquarters is in New York City, is going to be charged with anything. Not even a parking ticket, probably, after this clear conflict of interest that nobody seems to notice, nobody seems to care. Just
well, even if they did care, I think it's a clearly established fact now that the police departments of all countries are not what they're made out to be. They are corporations.
The enforcers, yeah.
That have won the contract by whatever means to be the enforcement agency for, if you like, you know, a whole lot of paperwork that's passed almost certainly without legal basis.
Yeah, so
without lawful, I should say, without lawful basis. You know, probably doesn't, you know, a lot of the stuff that's going on doesn't stand scrutiny and can't be enforced if people know how to do the approach properly. It looks like one of the airline companies in Australia has tacitly acknowledged that it didn't have the right or didn't have the legal capability to enforce the vaccine mandate. So things are starting to unravel for those companies. Some time ago, I was suggesting to you that large companies in Australia will be made bankrupt over this, and that it was a deliberate policy to do that. And that seems to be coming to fruition now. I think it's still going to be, you know, every aspect of it just benefits the guys that are trying to fulfill the plans that you and Living Man were discussing.
Yeah. Had you ever heard that legal term or that Latin term, usufructory?
No. Fructory means fruit, doesn't it?
Yeah. Because now the globalists in Canada, at least, because we're going to be the first post-nation state, so they're going to start conditioning Canadians to accepting their new plight. And I think one of our ministers of something or other was asked, do you think the government can just take the Russian oligarch ships if they parked in Canada? And he said, yeah, because property rights are not absolute in Canada.
That's right.
I think he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
He is telling the truth, but Canadians don't know the truth. So when it comes out, they're stunned by it.
Yeah. I did look up the post-nation state in Australia thing.
Yeah, okay.
And when I Googled it, it's taken 15 minutes for the article to come up. It said, oh, we're redirecting you and we're checking your something or other.
Wow.
But I've got something here. Yeah. I'll read the abstract to you. This is
all
called
right.
Globalization, Post-Nationalism and Australia by a fellow called Anthony Moran.
All right.
And the abstract is, it's published on October the 22nd, 2020. Abstract, post-national institutions and identities are products of globalization. How far along the post-national road the world has traveled is debatable.
Oh, hold that thought and just...
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Hello, I'm Northern Tracy, speaking from Ireland, and you're listening to Fakeologist Audio on fakeologist.com. What a mouthful.
Cheeky.
This car in front of me, opposing me, stopped for a small bird walking across the road. Oh, that's funny.
From the Tennessee Bird Walk.
A small bird would fly away if you approached it with a car, but this woman stopped while the bird walked across the road. It wasn't a chicken either. Just give me a sec here.
You can have as much sex as you like.
Yeah, all right. I'm going to. All right, we're back. Frank the Salt Guy and Ab the Fakeologist. Abarato.
I have just scanning this article. So, yes, there is talk of the post-nationalist state. So the jargon is all here.
Okay, so what do we got?
Well, it's so the abstract. It says, while the nation state is still an important institutional form, post-national identities and experiences challenge the boundaries of nation states and also national identities. Cosmopolitanism, as an outlook, set of predispositions and practices, is often seen as post-national and celebrated as such by whom? I've got no idea who would be celebrating these things, since it implies the embrace of humanity beyond nation. To what extent have national identities, as opposed to other kinds of identities, been threatened, undermined, or superseded by post-national identities? To what extent is the post-national a utopian hope for a cosmopolitan future? And to what extent is post-national already upon us, whether we recognize it or not? What are the most convincing examples of post-nationalism? This article addresses such questions with a focus on Australia. And there's a long, rather tedious article with lots of words in it.
Okay.
And the conclusion, when you get to it, is my response to the question raised at the beginning of this article is a complex one. There is not enough evidence to suggest that the world is post-national. On the one hand, the world displays features of post-nationalism, thought of best as post-national tendencies that are reflective of and respond to globalization and the transformed conditions under which nation states operate. Blah, 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 blah. So really, the whole thing totally ignores the fact that the 300 elite report to a couple of families and everything's controlled by them. So it's, and the only way you can make sense of what's going on in modern politics, in my opinion, is by using that model of the 300 that control everything.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a view on that?
That we need to...
But using any other models other than... You know, the 300 families controlling is that's the only model that seems to have any predictive power at all, as far as I can work out. If you're trying to work out why might the premier of my state blew up coal-fired power stations, it only makes sense that it was done at the directions of a group of guys that want to see people impoverished in Victoria.
Right.
There's no other explanation for what happened, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's true.
And now we've got a very severe crunch on power supplies in Victoria, which at one stage was the leading power provider in Australia. in our coldest winter.
Which plant? Which plant did you say was destroyed?
There's two: Hazelwood and Morwell power stations. Hazelwood was 60% of the generating capacity of Australia, of Victoria, I mean. 60%. And it was blown to kingdom come. They didn't salvage any of the generators. They didn't salvage the bucket wheel excavators and sell them. They just blew the thing up in situ.
Did you compare that to Nanticoke in Ontario?
Yes, you and I had that conversation before. Very similar thing has occurred there. No different at all as far as I can tell.
Was there a difference in size?
No, I don't think Nanticoke represented as big a percentage of the of the generating capacity, because you've got, I mean, Canada's got quite a lot of.
We have Niagara Falls.
Niagara Falls, yeah.
That's the big one. That is, it's brilliant because, of course.
But you can't help but think that they're going to work out a way to wreck that, can you? I mean, yeah. I can't see that power station being allowed to continue operating. And I'm just, trying to imagine how they're going to explain the fact that it suddenly shuts down. Would it be a log pass through the turbines or something? I don't know. I don't want to give these guys creative ideas about how to do it, but
yes, Nanticoke. Let me give you some facts.
Yeah.
Nanticoke had almost 4,000 megawatts of power.
Okay, and I'll tell you what Hazelwood.
It was replaced by a solar facility that generates, when the sun is out, 44 megawatts. So that's 1/100th of the power.
Yeah.
Not. When the sun is out, so yeah, talk about suicide. So that it was the biggest coal power plant in North America. I knew it.
Oh, right. So it was way because Hazelwood was 1,600 megawatts. What was yours again?
4,000.
Right, so yours was three times the size of Hazelwood. Just incredible. Just incredible.
And literally all they had to do is float the coal across Lake Erie to supply it. The coal, talk about generating near to where the resource is. That was about as close as you could get.
That's an incredible amount of power to lose, isn't it? 4,000 megawatts.
Well, it said here, at full capacity, with all eight generating units functioning, the station's annual electricity production had been as high as 24 billion kilowatt hours, which is enough electricity to run nearly 2.5 million households.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Just watching it all happen.
And that's back when we wanted to use electricity to entice industry to settle in Ontario. Literally advertised electricity at cost. That was the founding doctrine of Ontario Hydro. Electricity at cost, which I believe was as low as 1 cent per kilowatt hour.
It would have been lower. Yeah. Hazelwood was fractions of a cent per kilowatt hour.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, it's full on now, and I think if I look at I go back. It's Sunday, so it should be pretty cheap. That the current price 30 cents, and it's going to go up during the evening to 33 cents. During the day today, it got to 71 cents a kilowatt hour as being what they call the wholesale price for electricity in Victoria. And they just haven't got it. They're talking about blackouts when it gets very cold here.
Just it's funny, amazing. The decommissioning and shutting down of the plant didn't happen smoothly, that they made it seem like, oh, we need the power, we can't do it as quickly as we wanted to. But then they said it finally shut down on December 31st, 2013, thanks to in part by reactivating two units of the nuclear power plant, which is privately held by a British firm.
Mm.
The hilarious part of that is, well, we know nuclear power is probably completely fake. But just down the lake is, of course, probably the only real power plant, which is Niagara Falls. So you think that, oh, we could just build another reservoir or another sluiceway to make up for that loss of power?
LSP 33.
I'm Rachel.
Conor Coo.
From Original Stimulus.
Robbie Parker.
This is O'Hallahan.
You're listening to Fakeologist Radio at fakeologist.com.
But no, they don't bring up that would be possible or is happening. They never talk about Niagara Falls. Like, if you weren't paying attention, you probably wouldn't even realize that they generate power at Niagara Falls. It's probably the main power source of Ontario.
And there's probably still plenty of room and plenty of unused power to just add as much capacity as you wanted, really. You know, I doubt that all of the potential there has been exploited.
Well, yeah, because all they have to do is just divert the river a million ways to Sunday, because they have the terrain differential to work with.
Yeah. So it's really just, you know,
They could build all kinds of sluice ways parallel to the river, the drop, and create put more generators, more turbines on both sides of the river, America as well, because Niagara Falls, New York, on the other side of the river, is completely decimated in terms of industry.
Yeah.
It's a wasteland.
Well, you don't mean decimated. Decimated means reduced by 10%.
Yeah, it's obliterated.
Like our industry, yeah.
And when I used to drive over there, when I could go over the border without too much harassment, just seeing the network of high voltage lines all over the place in a sort of haphazard way, it's sort of, it's very ugly, of course, the rusted pylons that hold up the high voltage wires. And they still have power production, but I'm sure they could power all, even more.
If they wanted to, of course they could.
If they want to expand it. But I suppose the main reason they probably got rid of all the coal plants, even though they said it was because of acid rain and pollution, is it's just part of the plan to deindustrialize North America. You don't need the excess power if we're not going to be doing anything.
And they can't have people doing all this privatization stuff because if you've got too much power, how are you going to, you know, get any revenue from it? I mean, power should be free, really, just straight out free. All the infrastructure is paid for years and years and years ago.
Yeah, I agree. But if the long-term plan is to shut down North America, then you're not going to be in any kind of growth mode when it comes to power.
No, of course not. So that's right.
There can't be no real... Yeah, that to me is the easiest explanation. Why would you be cheering on shutting down of reliable power if you wanted to expand your state, your province, your country, your industry? It's like cheering that you are hobbling
But that's what I'm saying before. You're really, what you're saying only makes sense if you use the model that the world is controlled by the group of 300 and the families they report to. That's the only model that makes any sense there. And once you have that model in your mind, rather than it's the incompetence of various politicians or the corruption or the, you know, it's none of those things. It's just this is what the guys that run the place want. Then it's more relaxing, isn't it? You don't waste any of your energy complaining about it. It's just the way the world is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, just going back to the nuclear power station thing, just briefly, are you aware that Japan shut down all of its nuclear power plants after the Fukushima thing?
Fukushima? Yeah, well, I just assume so, because that would be the inciting incident.
Yeah, so there's no nuclear power in Japan. And there's been no change in the consumption of power in Japan, but there's been no blackouts or whiteouts or any other thing over there. So I don't think you could have a more stark example of the fact that nuclear power isn't a thing.
What is their official?
It's not even talked about. It's coal-fired power. It's mostly coal-fired power stations with coal bought from Australia. Which the Australian population apparently has to pay the carbon tax on. I just love it.
Let's see what we got here. In 2014, Japan consumed 995 terawatt hours of electricity, replaced mostly by coal and natural gas. No international connections. Four wide area synchronous grids.
Yeah, they're pretty impressive. Japan has got nothing. No electricity, no salt, no iron ore, no, it hasn't really got anything, and somehow it's become a major industrial power.
Mm-hmm. That's just because they work like slaves. It's all they do is work. I should go there. I'd probably fit in well. It says here that liquid natural gas.
So it also comes from Australia.
Gas, LNG, yeah.
Yeah, that comes from Australia as well, yeah. Yeah, compressed natural, yeah. And they get that for a fraction of the price that we have to pay for what is laughingly referred to as our own gas.
Yeah. Your gas belongs to the world, my friend. There's no countries when it comes to resources.
No.
So hydroelectricity is 16% of Japan's production. But all their hydropower didn't even add up to Nanticoke in Ontario.
Is that right?
As it says here, only 3,200 megawatts per year, megawatt hours.
So It's incredible that they were able to shut down 4,000 megawatts of power without a problem. They really did take out industry in the USA, didn't they?
In Canada, they really were, I guess so.
And just shut it down completely.
But I think it was they did say, and who knows, it was more of a backup plant for base power. I don't know when it was running at its peak. Maybe they, I know they shut Niagara Falls sluiceways down for a while to recondition all of them. That would be interesting if they decide to do that again.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, I better let you get to bed. Sure. I better get to bed. You're still really working hard in putting a whole lot of stuff out. Are you driving around at the moment doing your job, are you?
Yeah. I am right now. Now I'm just taking a break while I'm talking to you.
Yeah.
Tomorrow I'll have Stefan from Sanity for Sweden on. That guy sent a talk about tsunamis. He sent a tsunami of visitors to the website, which is great. Yesterday, yeah. It was anomalous. The traffic yesterday took me a second to figure out what was happening.
And he really blasted what's going on in Canada.
I know. He gives me more information about what's going on here than I glean for myself. So I'll just ask him what's happening here. I know he's going to want to ask me, because technically I should know better than him, but I'm going to ask him what's happening here.
So he's fantastic. His approach is refreshing, isn't it?
I like it. I think it's a great, he just does 5 minutes.
Just daggy and funny.
And he's very aggressive when it comes to posting his video. He puts it on YouTube. He puts it on BitChute. He puts it on Rumble. And now I see he's put it on brand new tube. He's all over the place.
Yeah. No,
I might have to give him, I think I'll give him a password on FakoTube. If he's going to be that diligent in putting it up in so many places. And it is a nuisance to do, by the way. It's not automated. So for him to post it every day, it probably wastes a good hour of his day. So I'm going to see if he'll put it on my site, because it's only 5 minutes a day, which wouldn't add up to very much of storage load on my server.
Well, that'd be great.
Yeah.
But funny. I just enjoy the way he expresses himself.
Yeah, I do too. And it's just enough. You know, 5 minutes a day of someone is very manageable.
Yeah.
So I'm grateful that he's coming on. I'll ask him if he can put his stuff up.
And Tony Heller is still my favorite environmental guy, even though he thinks the world is a globe. He is terrific.
Yeah. I don't get his notifications as reliably. I know he posts every single day, though. These people that can churn out the research every day, how do they do it? Because I'm just an amplifier, but these guys are doing quite original stuff.
Hmm. And he's not a baby. He's must be nearly 80 now. Obviously, his young Japanese girlfriend is keeping him.
I was just guessing he's in his 60s. You think he's way older?
I think he's, I'm 63, and he's talking about being at university 10 plus years before me.
Oh, okay. He makes two videos, one for YouTube and one for everyone else.
Yeah.
Which is more work.
Yeah.
But he's putting out something at least on average once a day. Yeah. Looks like he put three out. Oh, a hiding Australia's hot past. That's a video from yesterday. Did you get that one?
Yeah, he's done that before. So he's been very good. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, maybe he does a lot of recycling of videos, because why not if you have so much content?
Yeah, he's also, one day ago, he's put YouTube mocks themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, do you watch him on Rumble?
I watch him only on Rumble when he tells me to go there. I've subscribed to him on YouTube, and then
right,
he often provides.
He'll send you to Rumble.
Yeah.
I'll have to listen to him.
He's also written a couple of apps to help you, particularly for the US weather. You can zoom in on US historical information. He's managed to download it all. So that's very useful.
Yeah, with his kind of research, because it's so repetitive and because it's so clear, and he's made the case so well that the whole global warming is a fraud, I almost don't need to hear it anymore. I'm done. I get it. I know it's an ongoing battle, but I don't know how many more ways you can say it. What do you think on that? Do you think the same way, that that's enough?
I kind of think it's a war of attrition, so I like to keep putting his stuff out, posting it in social media.
Yeah.
It's some of the things he puts, I find occasionally refreshing. I mean, I don't watch all of his, I sort of binge. I might not watch him for a week or two.
Yeah.
But, because everything is tied up with global warming, it's a pretty substantive issue. We've got COVID because of global warming. We've got, all sorts of theft and piracy is taking place under the global warming umbrella.
Yeah. And COVID zero is going to be climate zero. What's going on in Shanghai seems to be real.
Yes, and you posted that on your favorite podcaster guys. That was good also.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it seemed like a on-the-ground report. Seemed real. Yep.
I have to commend you. Very negative. I don't know how you do it. Have you got a team of researchers backing you up with all this stuff? How are you keeping up with all this?
I know. It's just me. I have favorite sources, and the sources keep supplying new information. So it's really just me observing my hundreds of sources. Some of them go quiet, and I just have a lot of free driving time to make notes on, and I just bring it forth.
Right.
So you don't have to. I figure if I find someone or anyone finds something good, then they should share it. Question is, where do you share it?
You share it on your site. It's great. I think you'll find you're getting more and more people. As you say, you've got your own site, your own YouTube site. It's powerful. Yeah. What I will say is, though, that I have been graphing the rate of death, registered deaths in Victoria.
Yeah.
For several months now, and making the trends were indicating that there was going to be a large increase in registered deaths, and that is clearly still playing out. if the figures are to be believed, I've got no reason to disbelieve. So that's obviously not that great. For the citizenry, but I think it does highlight the idea that there is no harm being done by these injections is incorrect.
Yeah, has the rate increased in any age group? Because we really have to be careful when we try and interpret statistics. Because my goodness, can you ever manipulate statistics?
Okay, so
what
I
age group, yeah,
I don't know that. I have simply just taken.
Oh, after the break.
They guided me with psyops.
Psychological operations.
They guided me with psyops. They weaponized psychology. Hey.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.
I've simply taken the data, which becomes available at the end of every month, which is the total number of registered deaths for that month. And so in May 2020, there were 3,270 deaths. And in May 2022, there were 4,312 deaths registered. Now, that's an enormous increase. 1,100. You know, it's a third, an increase of a third.
33%. There's that number.
But so these are not great.
I'm just wondering if that increase is distributed evenly among the statistics from the past. So is that increase?
So there was an analysis that you posted of the Australian statistics up until February or something.
That's right.
Which indicates that younger people are dying at an increased rate, but by far the majority of the deaths are in the people that were vaccinated first, which is the elderly and the vulnerable. So he's saying it's not related to age, but related to the timing of the vaccination. So as each group got vaccinated, you know, there's an initial blast, and then 5 months later, there's another increase in death rate of the group that got vaccinated.
I still would guess that the plan would be to get rid of the seniors first, because they're not of any use to production.
Yeah.
So there's going to be any group that's most targeted, it would be seniors.
Yeah. Yeah, so at this rate, it's looking like there'll be an additional 1,100 or 1,200 deaths per month over what used to happen.
Cause of death, is it same?
It's mixed, although so the 2020 statistics for Australia said that COVID was the 38th leading cause of death. I'm fascinated by that statement, by the way. The 38th leading cause. Has anyone ever said that position 38 was a leading anything?
Yeah, it's leading the bottom.
The 38th leading cause of death. However, this year,
I caught
COVID has moved into fifth place.
Right.
So presumably that's happened all over the world. And one would have to question the efficacy of vaccinations under those circumstances, wouldn't one?
One should always question the efficacy of vaccinations in all circumstances.
So that's, I guess, the thing that's been interesting me is just watching the numbers.
Yeah, watching people drop off, yeah.
And I've been very interested in the Chinese story. I've got a friend that lives in Shanghai.
Oh, what are you hearing? Are you getting any firsthand?
Nothing really. She's very cagey.
Oh, too bad.
But they were locked up for quite a long time.
And they didn't test that lockup? They didn't try and get out?
She didn't, no.
Yeah. Yeah, every time I want to think that China is not playing along with this, stories like that emerge, and I think, well.
And that's the same with that story about Russia. You know, Russia's this and Russia's that. Russia is just
playing their part.
The most jabby people, aren't they?
Israel might be, but.
Russia's jabbing their people at a horrendous rate. So the idea that, you know, these saviors are doing anything other than just being part of the following the directions of the 300. I'd love to know where again, I can't follow the logic of people that should know better saying that Russia is somehow not part of the New World Order. Can you explain that to me?
No, only my beliefs want me to believe that Russia's not part of it, but I can't rationalize that with any evidence. They're doing their part.
You know, going on the numbers that I'm seeing, jabbing is a clear and present danger to living men and women. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And when they run out of willing receivers of the injection, that's when the non-injected should start to sweat a bit.
Well, what can you do about it when you say start to sweat? There's not a lot you can do,
yeah,
is there?
Not much. I'm not really worried because I just don't think they're going to force it. I think it's always consent-based.
Yeah, I mean, if it's forced, okay, then I've done what I can do, really. If they're gonna force it, really, you know, they're going to force it.
Yeah, they're just making life difficult, coercion right now, but nothing forced.
Yep. But they are forcing it. They can't be forcing it in China because they're saying that only 90% of Chinese are vaccinated. When I say only, they're saying 90% of Chinese are vaccinated. So there must be some mechanism for not being vaccinated, even in China.
Yeah. And even 90%, that number gets thrown around all the time everywhere. So I'm not confident with that number. I know it's probably high, but I don't know if it's 90.
That's right. So we're even being a little bit misinformed about China, aren't we?
We assume we're being misinformed about China.
Well, let me put it another way. The idea that we're given is that they're forcing vaccinations in China. If that's the case, then why isn't everybody vaccinated?
Yeah. So their story contradicts the idea that it's mandatory.
Well, to I can't see any other explanation. There must be some ability to escape being jabbed.
Yeah, and still live a little bit.
Yeah, there must be.
Are your airports in chaos?
Yes, total chaos.
Because that's the story we're hearing in Toronto. For the last, yeah. It bubbled up because an ex-hockey player made a tweet about it. So that
about Australian airports or about Canadian airports?
No, it was a Canadian hockey player promoted the idea that he's been at the Toronto airport for days, can't get out. Flight keeps moving and shifting, and so that bubbled it up. But it's an ongoing issue. I'm just curious if it's the same anywhere in Australia.
Yes, totally mad. Yep.
So all the stories are mirrored all throughout the world.
Correct.
We just don't hear about them. Yeah, so you have the same thing. So they're putting as much friction into air travel as possible to make people want to give it up.
That's how it appears, yeah, to me. And yet, the share price of Australia's largest airline has risen. I can't even work out how these businesses are still in business.
There must be subsidies, government subsidies.
Well, but, okay, yeah. So what?
Yeah. Well, maybe their employees are being paid by the government, or they're laid off.
But they must have. Or, I'm just thinking out loud now. I mean, the Australian Airlines would have borrowed enormous sums of money to rent these planes because they're, you know, hugely expensive items. I mean, it's really, as far as I can work out, air travel is just a way of funding the operations of the Swiss banks. It, you know, no one owns anything. It's all just done on borrowings and interest payments. And
yeah.
So none of the existence of airlines makes sense at all at the moment because they cannot possibly be generating enough income to cover their costs.
Yeah, there must be some sleight of hand going on.
Yep. But the share price going up is just, that is totally nonplussing. These guys have been out of action for two or more years, and they're not running well now. They're having a terrible time, as you say, with breaks at airports. It's just another one of these things that don't really add up to me, anyway.
Yeah. I think the goal is for the federal government just to federalize air travel. They'll just own the planes all around the world, I think. That way they can control them.
Our government did own the planes and they sold them off. They privatized it.
Yeah. Okay, so they can do it again. They can just bring them back in with the loans. You loan the corporations money to keep going based on the problems you created, then you can't pay for the loan, then you get the property and the assets back under fold.
I guess, yeah.
And everyone will accept it because that's the natural order of bankruptcy.
Yeah. All right, Abby, well, thank you for the chat. And
thank you, Frank. All the best.
I don't know how you're doing it. It's very impressive.
I'm trying. I'm having fun. As long as I'm having fun, it's not work. So I'm enjoying it. And thanks for your support. I appreciate it.
I have a question about your daughter. Did you try the keto thing or not?
Well, I can't try anything because it's not my body. I know people like to think. So, no, she's not doing that. No. She likes carbs.
Yep.
She doesn't think she should have to turn her life more upside down. She has a balanced diet. She does not eat to excess. So no, someone else sent me the keto diet, and I did look it up in type 1 diabetes context.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure you're going to get good, truthful information online about it.
Yeah.
But it sounds like it is complicated and not as simple for a type 1.
Okay.
And I don't think there's any pathway besides a pancreas transplant to stop insulin. You can reduce it, but you can't stop it. So, but it almost doesn't make a difference if you think about it. If you're not making any insulin or not nearly enough to make a difference, then you need to have a way to get it in your body. So if you took 1 unit or 10 units of insulin, there isn't much difference to your daily life. You can't stop your monitoring. You can't stop your administration of insulin. So then we're just talking about quantities.
Okay.
Sort of the old joke about taking money for sex.
Yeah, what's that old joke?
I'm trying to remember because I haven't told in a while. We go and ask a woman, you know, if I gave you $100, would you have sex with me?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. It's a George Bernard Shaw thing.
Oh, you know about it? I can't remember it well enough. You probably
well, the George Bernard Shaw apparently approached a high society woman and said, "Madam, if I paid you 100 guineas, would you have sex with me?" And she said, "Well,
yeah,
I would, Mr. Shaw." He said, "Madam, if I paid you 10 shillings, would you have sex with me?" She said, "Mr. Shaw, what sort of woman do you think I am?" And he said, "Well, I think we've already established what sort of woman you are. We're simply haggling about the price."
Yeah, that's right. That's what it is. That's right. Yeah, exactly. So it's sort of the same idea that you need the infrastructure, and you're not going to get away with as a type 1 with stopping your insulin, I don't think. So then if you just start with a unbalanced diet, when the keto diet is by all accounts an unbalanced type of diet, you're emphasizing one food group and trying to eliminate another, then you're going to make some serious waves in your body, and you're going to have to compensate with those waves. And the whole idea about maintaining a stasis of insulin in your body is the goal is to have a very flat line of insulin levels in your body, because it's the ups and downs that cause problems. So if you are...
But presumably, even though you're saying she's not doing anything, this discussion with her about it is going to, I think without any other change, she is almost certainly conscious now about her carb intake. And she has altered her behavior and the carbs she brings in.
Oh my God, it's ridiculous. She doesn't even. It's funny because she uses a notepad to write down all after the break diabetes. Hey, hey, baby, I got your money.
Would you like to support Fakeologist.com and all the content we're creating? We operate on the value for value principle, where you pay whatever you can for whatever value you feel you've received. We accept donations in almost every form, from PayPal to Bitcoin. Please go to fakeologist.com/donate for your payment options. Thank you for your support.
Yeah, it's kind of amusing because she uses the low-tech method of tracking carbs. She uses a notepad with a pen. Yeah. So if she's eating something, she'll flip through the notepad to find the calculations she used to get the carbs of all the ingredients in the meal. Because we have a repertoire of food on meals. Yep. So I'm amused by it because, like all young people, she's connected to her phone, but she doesn't keep track of her meals on the phone. She has a notepad. So we always have to wait, and it's not even organized in any logical fashion. She just flips through the pages all the time. Well, where's this calculation? So that way she doesn't have to get the ingredients list of, say, a spaghetti dinner. But, it's just a constant awareness.
So that thing about the spaghetti, I mean, for me personally, getting rid of bread and spaghetti type stuff, that's been the easiest part. I just bailed out of it, really, without any problem. It's the wheat and pasta stuff, the bread. But basically, I've cut to pretty much a minimum, really. I don't entirely avoid it. But that made a very large difference on my waist circumference.
Mike, I should probably stop too, but I just try and eat less food. But I don't really want to get rid of all the things I like.
But I've been very, very hungry during this cold winter. But it's literally, steak and eggs, all the good food, fried food, as long as it's fried in saturated fats and, delicious, salty, yummy food. I don't find it to be a suffering thing at all, but it's interesting.
You do, saturated fat. What do you purchase to fry your food?
Butter.
Lard.
Lard. Yeah.
Butter. Okay.
Mostly butter. I was using coconut fat for a long time, but I find the taste of coconut fat to be not that great. Dripping is also great. Rather than lard, dripping is beef based. And I cook a lot of lamb, so the fat that gets rendered from the cooking, I keep all that for frying chips and so on.
Have you ever tried bacon fat?
Yeah, pig fat? Bacon fat is dripping. Oh, sorry, is lard.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I just realized that we collect a lot of that because she eats a lot of bacon.
Yeah, well, there you go.
There's a lot of, we have jars of fat. I usually throw them out. I should probably keep them.
Oh, okay. So that's the stuff that I use for cooking. I use lamb fat, bacon fat, and butter.
Yeah, we don't eat many fried foods, so it's not never been.
Yeah, so I have a lot of fried food. All cooked with butter or
so lard, again, or getting back to the diabetes, I'm not sure what a keto diet would really, how it would change your life.
Well, it's really once you take out the story, sorry, I should say, the story is that once you take out the wheat-related stuff is that it reduces the amount of insulin required, insulin resistance.
But she doesn't have insulin resistance. She just doesn't have insulin. That's why they should not even be called the same thing. Type 2 and type 1 diabetes should not both be called diabetes.
Right.
And that's the problem. But, yeah, getting back to what I think is the dangerous part of diabetes is the ups and downs. I don't know if most type 2 diabetes measure their continuous insulin levels, but she does. So she gets a reading every 5 minutes from her transhumanist sensor on her arm.
Yeah.
So you can see every day the graph. And some days it is up and down like the Swiss Alps, which is not good. And reading some of the forums where these diabetics communicate, some of them have been type 1 for 20 or 30 years, and they say they have no idea why they have certain days that are just up and down. There's just not enough inputs into the equation to figure out what has changed. They say they might have the same sleep pattern, same hormonal pattern, the same food pattern, but they get a day where they go on a roller coaster, a roller coaster ride on the graph.
Yeah.
Where the next day it could be a flat line in the proper range. So that's the frustration, because we just don't know what the pancreas is doing half the time. That's the problem for them.
Okay.
So those low carb down under guys,
and the Iva Cummins, I think give pretty good explanations for both type 1 and type 2, but yeah, understood. I just don't think pasta and bread is worth having in your life anyway. Just think it's rubbish, really.
I love bread. Not crazy about pasta because I can't eat eggs, and most good pasta has egg in it. So I don't really eat pasta. I eat the fake stuff, the industrial stuff, which is probably no good for you either. But, yeah, it's with a type 1 diabetic, the most dangerous situation is being going into insulin shock, which is
not enough insulin.
Not enough carbs, not enough sugar. So if you go hypoglycemic,
yeah,
that's the most dangerous situation to be in. You're better off to be hyperglycemic, too much sugar, because as somebody said, it takes 30 minutes to die of hypoglycemia, but about 30 years to die of hyperglycemia. So you can see...
My understanding of the too little sugar only occurs when they overdo the dose of insulin.
Yeah. Well, that yes.
And so I guess the key advantage of
yeah, the poison's in the dose.
Yeah, so the key advantage of cutting down the carbs is to reduce the overall loading of insulin.
Yeah.
According to these guys.
Yeah, of course. Well, she was walking around probably for at least a year in a hyperglycemic state until one day it just was... At 33, which apparently is the magic number for really being completely what they call DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis. And that's when your whole body just says, I've had enough, I can't, and you just collapse. but she could have been in a hyperglycemic state for a year easily.
Yeah,
and that just has that causes all kinds of long-term and chronic and slow degradation of your system. Whereas, again, if you go hypo, where you have more insulin than sugar to process, because
it's fatal. It's quite often fatal.
You'll go into a comatose state, at which point you will not be able to realize or react or do anything about it.
No.
Once you go under, you can't get out. Your body will not do anything to get out of that state. So if you're unattended, you will die.
Yeah.
And that happens at night when you're asleep.
Yeah.
So that's one of the more dangerous times for a diabetic is sleeping. Extended sleeping. And that's typically when her body will go hypoglycemic.
Yeah.
At night. And with technology, the phone will wake her up, start screaming at her. But before that, what happened? Well, diabetics died, I guess. Or they would need to be awakened with a needle and a paramedic.
It would be interesting to know what the statistics were for diabetes pre-introduction of needles, as you suspect that jabbing has been the cause.
Well, had how many people were diabetic anyway before vaccination?
Well, that's
vascular ischemia, which was destroying endovascular tissue like pancreases.
Yeah.
That's a great question. I'm sure there's no real studies or information because we've been vaccinating people for 150 years. So it's a long time. Anytime before there, I'm sure there wasn't a lot of great record keeping. There really wasn't an organized medical industry either, I don't think, in the same way. But yeah, getting back to this being hypoglycemic. You see, I think if you're if you're not a diabetic and you go hypoglycemic, that's when you go into, I think, ketoacidosis. That's when your body will go to glycogen stores in the liver and the fatty tissues looking for sugar to process. And that's why you could lose weight that way, because if you deprive your body of glucose, then
it burns ketones instead. Yeah,
right. So then it goes to other deposits of glycogen that it can metabolize, and theoretically that's your fat reserves, or it could be in your liver. Now I don't see, it seems to me, just without any research, that a type 1 diabetic, the body doesn't do that. Because it doesn't have enough of the equation, and whatever the chemical equation is, it's not just too much insulin. It's really that it doesn't have any free available glucose to process.
And one of the things that I sent, one of the things I sent to you was about how the ketone process overcomes that thing you're talking about. So if you operate in the keto state, you the fact that haven't got glucose is not important. You operate in the ketosis state. Your you're getting your energy from processing ketones.
Is that called ketoacidosis?
No, ketoacidosis is an extreme state. But when you fast, for example, I fast every couple of months, you go into, you start generating your energy through ketosis. That's the, if you like, what this story is all about. The idea that the only way that you can live is through glucose is considered to be the fallacy here. That you can operate in permanent ketosis, and people are operating in that state.
The idea is that that's a healthier state to operate in under.
Well, I would have thought, particularly for someone who is a diabetic.
But DKA is.
You've gone off air.
What you're saying?
We lost you off the air for a little bit there at the vital.
Yeah. So
the assumption. I think the assumption you're operating under is that if you have no carbs, that you will end up with ketoacidosis, right? And one of the primary cause of acidosis, and I think I've talked to you about this before, is not enough salt. You can't go into acidosis if you have a lot of salt. But one of the things that happens in a keto diet is that you will need to pump up your salt intake. That has been demonstrated over and over again. But the people that do that, who can more very successfully operate in a permanent state of ketosis. But I'm not a doctor. You would have to look at these.
I just don't really know. But again, it's called DKA, diabetic ketoacidosis. So what is chemically going on?
Well, what's chemically going on is that the pH of your in a normal person, in a well regulated person, the pH of your blood and your other bodily fluids, what I call the inside your body. Remember, I keep talking about the hole between your mouth and your anus as being outside your body, but your bodily fluids between your intestine and your skin are held in a close range of pH between 7.35 and 7.45. And that level of pH is maintained when the parietal cells of your stomach convert salt into bicarbonate. The bicarbonate goes inside your bloodstream to maintain your pH in that range between 7.35 and 7.45. When people enter a keto diet, what they find is that they start to lose salt at a pretty high rate. And so you have to pump up the salt intake to prevent that. And the way to prevent that acidosis is through increased salt intake.
Okay. So acidosis literally means that your blood is going from a basic state to an acidic state.
Yes.
After the break.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
And hello, everybody. This is Lost Spider Fowlis from Los Angeles, California. You're listening to Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.
So what I'm saying here is that acidosis is not some mystery state at all. It is a state where you don't have enough bicarbonate ion in your blood. And you'll be able to confirm that by talking to any doctor or medical profession. Acidosis means you don't have enough bicarbonate in your blood. And the bicarbonate ion comes from the breaking down of salt into hydrochloric acid, which stays inside your stomach and makes you and produces the hydrochloric acid to digest your food, and sodium bicarbonate ion, which stays inside your body and keeps your blood alkaline. So it's this acid-base balance that I've talked about several times.
So they call it ketoacidosis. Why do they call it ketoacidosis?
Because when you have a low carb diet, the body chemistry moves from glycogen system to a ketone system, and what happens is you start to lose salt. You lose the bicarbonate ion. Your demand for salt increases quite a lot, and people don't take in enough salt in their diet to compensate for the problems. And that's actually talked about in a couple of the talks on the low carb down under people. They explain the reason why you need more salt if you start to do a keto diet.
So they're saying the ketoacidosis means the acidosis is caused by the breaking down of ketones.
The acidosis is caused by you just not having enough salt to compensate for the salt losses that occur as a result of getting your energy through ketones rather than glucose.
So that process of breaking down the ketones acidifies the blood more.
I don't think it's that process that acidifies the blood. The consequence is that bicarbonate ion must be being chewed up, and you need to compensate. You need to have more bicarbonate ion available, and because you don't have enough salt, you're not producing enough bicarbonate ion to compensate for the what's going on when you eat a keto diet.
I gotcha. So lots of salt with your protein.
Well, when you go into ketosis, you need to have more salt than you would. You know, you need to have the sort of levels of salt that I talk about 15 grams a day, really.
And most people have 0 to maybe a couple grams.
Well, they'd have bugger all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess a lot of salt. So a lot of our salt does come from processed foods, though. So if you're cutting out all the carbs and the processed foods, that might explain why you're not getting as much salt in your system in general. Is that right? Is that salt the same?
Well, that would also be a problem, yeah. So people that are eating keto are not getting processed food. So, yeah, that would obviously reduce their salt intake anyway. But it is a well-understood phenomenon that if you eat keto, you need more salt in your diet. Now, I haven't got the explanation completely correct, and I would have to go and refresh my study of the low carb down under people's talks, but I could do that and I'll find the relevant talk and send that to you because I think you'll find it interesting.
So when you eat your steak, put lots of salt on it.
Yeah. Well, if you cut it, basically, if you cut out processed carbs, if you cut out wheat and sugar and pasta, your demand, your need for salt will increase. It's a well-documented and well-understood phenomenon. And it's also well understood that ketosis is only a problem if you don't have enough salt.
Right. You mean ketoacidosis? Isn't that different from ketosis?
Ketosis is where your body is processing for its energy ketones rather than glucose. And acidosis is a situation where the pH of your blood has fallen below 7.35. Now, you're not necessarily going to get acidosis when you're in a ketone state. I go into ketosis regularly and I don't get acidosis. You know, when I fast for 7 days, I'm clearly in ketosis. You can smell it on your breath. It's a very clear, very clear sign.
When you fast, what do you eat?
Well, the last one, I didn't eat anything. I just had salty water.
Wow.
Some cups of coffee. With salt in, yeah.
Do you just sit still for the week, or how can you function?
No, I work. I just do, because I'm fat.
Go about your day.
I just live a normal life.
And what happens in that week to your body, besides getting bad breath?
Well, it's not bad breath. It's just you can smell that it goes into ketone. You can smell the ketones.
What does it smell like?
Like fingernail polish.
Oh, isn't that ammonia?
No, it's acetone.
Acetone.
Acetone. You know the polish. You know the stuff to remove fingernail polish. Sorry, I made the wrong.
Do you smell like acetone?
Yeah. Your breath has acetone smell.
So do you notice any other change after a fast? What else do you notice?
I just noticed that I'm staying in good physical condition. I can, you know, function well.
If you don't fast, how do you know the difference?
You don't really know. The only thing I can say to you is that the concept of fasting is that after 3 days, the process of cell division stops. And so that you end up giving yourself a kind of natural chemotherapy. And I think this process of cell division is called mitosis. Let me check that out.
Right. There's meiosis and mitosis.
What is mitosis? In cell biology, mitosis is the part of the cell in which replicate. Okay, yeah. So mitosis, after 3 days of fasting, mitosis stops. And in that time, your body does repair things and, you know, things that are out of whack are dealt with, is the story. And people that have that are strictly ketogenic are effectively processing ketones all the time.
Well, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's a very interesting concept, but I find it interesting that, you know, you've been told that the acidosis is related to the low carb level. Acidosis, the only cause of acidosis is insufficient bicarbonate production for your body's needs. That's the only cause of acidosis. And how's that for a powerful statement? No punches pulled.
Yeah, it's not something we're taught in any level, on any level.
No.
Just not, it's not widespread information. Nobody talks to your doctor in the medical system.
If you talk to your if you talk to the doctor about it the next time and ask him what, you could say to him, I've been told that acidosis is a lack of bicarbonate ion in the blood. Is that true? And see what happens. See what he says. In fact, I should be able to Google that for you and send you the link. What is acidosis? Okay, so I'll read out what Healthline says about metabolic acidosis. The pH of your blood should be around 7.4. Acidosis is characterized by a pH of 7.35 or lower. Okay. Alkalosis is characterized by a pH level of 7.45 or higher. Now, you will never see that. And it talks about a whole bunch of stuff. But the way they measure the pH of your blood is by working out what the what the level of bicarbonate ion is in your blood. So if you're told that you're in acidosis and you ask them how they measure it, they don't measure it by working out how much acid is in your blood. They work out the pH by how much bicarbonate is in your blood.
Yeah, the bicarbonate ion, which is correct. The measure of alkalinity.
Yeah. Hypochloric acidosis results from a loss of sodium bicarbonate. This base helps keep the blood neutral. Now, here's an interesting thing here. And doctors, this is fascinating to me. Let me read out this little sentence. Hypochloremic acidosis, which results from a loss of sodium bicarbonate. This base helps keep the blood neutral. Okay. But the blood is not neutral because they've already told you the pH of your blood should be around 7.4. Now, doctors say that 7.4 is neutral alkalinity, but that's not true. Neutral pH is 7.0. So doctors are taught that your blood is neutral pH, even though it's actually alkaline.
Right.
It's really, really. I'll send you this little link. It's really interesting.
So neutral is officially 7.
Neutral is 7.
That's
real. But yeah. Doctors are taught that neutral is 7.4.
They move the 0 point. 7.4.
Yep. So, and if you talk to a doctor about, I've got to keep myself alkaline, they say, oh, that's all nonsense.
When in fact, you do have to be alkaline because that's the norm. That's the baseline for your blood.
That's
alkaline.
The baseline for the pH of your blood should be around 7.4, straight out of
alkaline.
Alkaline. I'll just post that in the show notes.
And one of the tropes we always hear in the truth community is you get cancer because your blood is acidic.
Well, that's absolutely true.
Right.
Once your pH of your blood moves out of the range between 7.35 and 7.45, it's chaos for your body. And that's why the only way to make the bicarbonate ion is from salt. There is no other way to make bicarbonate ion in your body. If you swallow bicarbonate, it will not put any bicarbonate into your bloodstream. Bicarbonate can only get into your bloodstream when the parietal cells interact with salt and carbon dioxide from your breathing and water to produce sodium bicarbonate and hydrochloric acid. That's the only way that you have any bicarbonate in your body. It comes from the metabolism of salt. Crazy stuff.
Oh, well, we've learned a lot. Yeah, it's good information.
And then, interestingly, Ab, on the bottom of this thing that I've just sent you.
Yeah.
Is this thing about diabetes? Wow.
Okay, what's it say?
It just popped up. Oh, it's gone away again. Oh, yeah. So in that link I just sent you, halfway along it says Healthline Resources, Diabetes Nutrition Made Easy in just 10 minutes a week. Our free weekly micro lessons can empower you with wisdom you need to make healthy changes for your diabetes. Short and easy to follow up steps in the week ahead.
Oh, it's an advert.
It's an ad, yeah.
I wonder if there's any way we can track the incidence of type 1 diabetes. It's got to be increasing with the poisoning of the end vascular tissue in the bodies from the vaccine over the last 2 years. Has to be.
I would have said so.
But I think the problem is it's a slow process. It may not be temporally connected.
You're listening to another hour of Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.
So it may take years to reflect on the statistics, and then they can claim it's other things as well. The passage of time becomes dilution of the cause and effect.
In this article that I've read to you, it's got here, sodium bicarbonate or baking soda is often given to people with certain types of metabolic acidosis. The chemical compound that's often used to treat heartburn by neutralizing stomach acid. When used to treat metabolic acidosis, it can help make your body's fluids more alkaline or raise the pH of your blood. The doctor may give you sodium bicarbonate either by mouth or by IV. A 2014 study showed it's useful when your acidosis is caused by the loss of sodium bicarbonate in your system. This is often caused by diarrhea. Okay? So they're completely ignoring the well-known acid-base knowledge that bicarbonate is produced from salt.
All right. Well, they're saying diarrhea just means that your hydration level goes down.
Yeah.
So they're saying, when your hydration level goes down in your blood, then your acid level goes up. Your pH goes down.
I'm not even sure what they're saying. But effectively, they are telling you that the way that they treat acidosis is bicarbonate as an IV, intravenous drip. 'Electrolytes. Doctors diagnose acidosis with a series of blood tests. One of the most common is to measure your anion gap. Anion gap is the difference between positively and negatively charged electrolytes in your blood.
All right.
Anyway, it's well worth reading that. It, as I said, the It's about sodium bicarbonate. The treatment for it is sodium bicarbonate. And the way to produce sodium bicarbonate is to have salt in your diet, and you just won't get into that situation in the first place.
Well, are they telling you to eat baking soda?
Yes, and you shouldn't listen to that advice. Well, sorry, I'm not a doctor, but salt's a much better way to do it.
Well, does eating baking soda do anything to increase your carbonate level in your blood? Because it's doing different things on the outside of your body and your stomach.
Yeah, I'll tell you how it does it. It does it in the short term because when you eat sodium bicarbonate, it neutralizes your stomach acid, which causes your body to make more stomach acid. And by doing that, your body will produce more bicarbonate ion at the same time. But the problem is, if you haven't got sufficient salt, you will deplete your chloride levels in your body, and it won't work forever. The sensible way to get more bicarbonate in your body is to have more salt. And we know that this is occurring because the IV drips, all IV drips will contain salt, even the ones, you know, when it talks about having an IV drip with sodium bicarbonate in it, that IV drip must also have an isotonic level of salt at 8 grams per liter. There's nothing that's injected into your arm that doesn't have an isotonic salt solution as its base in an IV drip.
Did you say acids based?
There is no intravenous drip that will be put into your arm that doesn't have the base fluid for the drip will contain salt at what's called an isotonic level of salt at about 9 grams per liter of the fluid will be salt. And then they'll put something else in it. Because if you don't do that, you will.
Don't do that, what'll happen? If you don't do that, what'll happen, Frank? 2212.
Ooh.
Are you still there?
I'm trying to be. Can you hear me?
I can.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
If you do not have. If you have an injection, a drip put into your arm, fluid of some kind, it might be to put an antibiotic in or something, or some sodium bicarbonate, as they talk about here. If that fluid doesn't contain 8 grams to 9 grams a liter of salt, then that fluid dripped into your arm will kill you.
For poisoning.
Yeah, did you hear that?
Yeah.
Yeah, so
iso means the same. It has to have the same levels of salt as your blood. I got that.
Yeah. And if that does not happen, it will kill you.
Right, I gotcha.
So if you inject a liter of water into your bloodstream, you'll die, basically.
Because you will be if you dilute your
you'll dilute your blood
acid or base?
Well, what will happen is you'll become hyponatremic, lacking in salt, and all sorts of chaos then breaks out. Hyponatremia usually results in death. Hyponatremia is when the blood concentration of salt falls below 8 grams per liter. And if you inject water into your bloodstream, you will cause that dilution to occur. Did you follow that, Ab, or not?
I'm good. Yeah. I gotcha.
So it's interesting that even in this article, they're connecting diabetes and what they call an alkaline diet and so on. And this thing about the alkaline diet, is also known as the acid alkaline diet or the alkaline ash diet. It is the premise that your diet can alter the pH value, the measure of acidity or alkalinity of your body. And what I'm going to suggest to you is that all of that is total nonsense. The only way to maintain the right level of alkalinity is to have the right level of salt or enough salt.
Well, how do you, so when you have a glass of water,
yep.
How do you salt that? How do you determine the grams per liter?
I just put it into taste.
Oh, okay. But your taste is saltier probably than most people's.
Well, if people are taking in salt through their diet normally, so having a glass of water, you're not injecting it, you're just drinking it. So your body will take what it needs and excrete what it doesn't need. So if you drink a lot of water, you'll go to the toilet a lot, you'll pee a lot.
Right. Because your body doesn't need it.
Your body doesn't need it. The story is that if you're doing a marathon or anything, you shouldn't drink anything while you're doing your marathon. You should wait until you finish and recover properly. But people that drink, in the 80s and 90s, people would run a marathon and they'd drink a lot of water along the way. And you would see them melt down. Their muscles would melt from this effect of hyponatremia, where they diluted their
salt level.
Fluids. Yeah. By drinking the water, they just made their blood too dilute for salt.
So they could drink salt water, and that would, I guess they call that electrolytes.
Yeah, they
do. It's called electrolytes.
That's right. Well, remember Gatorade, the original Gatorade that the basketball team became famous for.
Yeah.
Well, that original Gatorade was probably something like seawater diluted.
Well, just soda has more salt than sugar. Is that right? Like a Coca-Cola, they use sugar to mask the salt taste.
Probably.
Did you know that?
Salt and sugar together are not great.
But that's what soda is.
Yes, I don't think anyone's arguing that drinking soda drinks is a good idea.
Well, that's carbonated water plus salt plus sugar.
Plus salt and sugar. And the salt and sugar are really the worst combination. Just as bad as it gets, really.
Wow. So a runner should just drink an electrolyte drink, which is probably quite salty, I guess.
Well, a runner, during the run, according to my brother-in-law, who's a bit of a guru on this stuff, shouldn't do anything. They should let their body develop its own level of homeostasis during the activity. And provided you're adequately prepared for the run with training and diet and the right level of fluids and intake before the run, you should run the run and not do anything, because it's quite stressful to take in anything while you're running.
Yeah, I would just say in general, running long distances is a bad idea.
Yeah, that's my view. But as I said, if you're going to do it, just do the run and then sort out the rest later on.
Yeah, we were never supposed to run a marathon. So that's my way out of it.
Yeah.
Well, I see Tea Time has joined the room. And you want to leave the room. I want to have a nap. But we could say hello to Tea Time.
Good morning. How's everybody?
Good morning.
We've been going for 6 hours.
Norskovy Telesvinsky, yeah?
Yes, Tola Svinsky, yeah.
Are you Swedish?
I'm half Irish and half something else. I used to be from the East Coast, Philadelphia, but now I'm in the desert in Southeast Oregon.
You're not John Levi, eh? You sound like John Levi.
No, but he is nearby. He's definitely nearby.
Oh, wow.
I mean, by location, we're in the same part of the world, he and I.
Right. Have you ever been tempted to go and say hello?
No, but I've definitely gone inside his mind and his heart through his YouTube productions. He may have seen some of mine. I'm on YouTube also.
And what's your analysis of his
I've started in earnest around 2004, so I ran steady myself till 2017 and doing self-realization since then. So my priority list is a little bit different.
Okay.
I'm happy with his work. You know, it's a great analysis and, it's very in-depth, and it's very thoughtful. So, yeah, I really enjoy spending time. But I don't really do that anymore. I used to do it full-time, but I'm just not a YouTube watcher like I used to be.
Yeah. So what's your main source of opinion forming now?
Well, I had previous training with a Sufi sheikh in person when I was a child from 1971 to 1978. So I've been holding that candle lit my whole life and pretty much basing my observations with that as a baseline. So now that I'm finally grown and beat up enough, I'm willing to sit down and think about it in a normal way.
So what do you think is a normal way?
That we should be living to do no harm, and we should be striving to regard all lives as our own. What that does is it releases us from cognitive dissonance, which is the number one issue facing the world today. All other issues are after that. They have lots of
You know, I agree with that.
Yes, thank you.
I doubt if I could agree with anything more than what you just said. Cognitive dissonance is the key problem.
Yes, and what it actually, once it's resolved, what it reveals is quite fantastic, actually. So human condition is super, super fantastic and dynamic. And we've basically found a myriad of ways to isolate it and reduce it, which is interesting in itself. But even the word inter is the root of interesting, has its own set of interesting and not so interesting aspects to it. So we see this mirror pretty much everywhere. The mirror is everywhere, and that seems to be the main source of antagonism, but not the mirror, but which side of the mirror to focus on. Or is the mirror even the problem? So I don't think the mirror is the problem. I think it's just something that's part of the format of our existence, that it's something to learn from. I mean, yeah, of course, we find ourselves in this duality mirror, but nevertheless, that's the hand we're dealt with. So I submit that we go forward with what we're dealt with and play our hand to the best of our ability.
Which means what to you?
It means that we should live our lives as best we can to do no harm and strive to regard all lives as our own. This can be achieved through relieving ourselves of cognitive dissonance, because what is revealed when the dissonance is removed is cognitive harmony. And what, excuse me for 1 second, I'll continue.
Hi, this is John Friend.
This is Mizo.
Joe from Atlanta.
Joe Mama. Gaia.
I'm Buck Cherry.
It's me.
You're listening to Fakeologist Radio at Fakeologist.com.
So once the cognitive harmony is revealed, that's just a two-word phrase. What does that mean? So when the harmony has been revealed or has occurred, it means that the rational brain and the emotional spiritual brain, your left and your right brain, are no longer antagonized or disputing. In other words, they're in agreement. That's why there's harmony. So when this harmony happens between the left and the right brain, there's an ease of stress, ease of antagonism. There's virtually a space occurring now between the left and the right brain, a relaxing, which allows the entry of the heart, brain, intelligence, and energy to more peacefully move through that space into your Ark of the Covenant area in the rear of your brain, where all creation is happening, powered by the heart. Happening there.
So you think all creation is happening inside our brains?
Base of the brain.
So it's not happening by God creating things?
Oh, no, it is definitely God creating things.
So, there's a difference.
God rides as a partner to the human being as a very small, light atomic ray particle inside the beating heart. So God literally exists there in total as a particle. And then powers all of the systems of your body and all your cells from there. But you yourself, as the other partner, are riding in the base of your brain. You see yourself in the front of your brain. At least that's how we've developed, underdeveloped, whatever you want to call it, to the point we're at right now. So where we're at today, most people focus on their neocortex sensual nature, and they reduce themselves to that point. So they pretty much ignore the base of their brain, their creation mechanism, and their creation power, which is coming from their heart. Simply ignore it and focus on their sensual nature and whatever discussions are going on nearby. So, you know, people can reduce themselves or they can advance themselves. Like, we all have a choice. That's part of the mirror. A part of where we're at today is an extreme of all things. So why, I don't have the answers to why, but I can talk about the letter why. But I think I've talked enough for now.
And how do you get from a state of cognitive dissonance to a state of cognitive peace?
Well, you have two brains. You have a logical brain, a rational brain, on the left side that controls the right side of your body. You have a right brain, spiritual and emotional, and it controls the left side of your body. So when your actions are agreeable, both of your brains, then you have cognitive harmony. If there's no agreement, then you must weigh cover for that when you're challenged. Whether you're challenging yourself or the world is challenging you or someone you love is challenging you, you have to be able to either run away or fight to cover for your dissonance. So this only makes it stronger, the dissonance, because every time that you come up with an excuse or run away from the fight, you basically validate that cognitive dissonance. So you make it more real, you make it more acceptable. So this can build on itself moment by moment, day by day, year by year, and people can forget that they've allowed themselves to go there. So once you decide you just want to repair yourself, then you just pick things out one at a time. You don't ever put too much pressure on yourself because you don't want to get depressed and lose your mojo. So the mojo is the most important thing. You have to keep this center line. If you recognize the center line, then at least you see yourself in these multiple parts. So then you at least have something to work on as a baseline. You can see yourself as an outline. You're not a mushmash that can't be figured out. You know, so you have a logical side, you have an emotional side, and you have a center line. So just imagine that in your mind's eye, that you have these pieces. So once you know you have these pieces, then you can start to sort things out a little bit, and then you just pick things that are easy. It's like as if you wanted to go debt-free. Like, let's say you got 60 grand in debt on 20 credit cards. So that's fucked up, right? So you're not going to answer that in one day. So you pick the one that has like $280 balance on it, and you work on that one. Get rid of it. No, get rid of that one. So that's the same way with cognitive dissonance. So you know that you're fucked up, and you know you got a lot of issues. Some are bigger than others. So you just start considering them. You know, you don't have to do anything. You just have to consider it as an idea. So once you start doing that, you're operating from your center line. You're not pushing yourself to a rational or an emotional argument. You're just not doing that. You're accepting that you can operate from the center without any fucking decisions being made. Now you give yourself that fucking peace to start with for yourself. Stop letting the world push you around and tell you're a piece of shit. You're not. You have control of yourself. So you grab that center line and you say, I'm taking control. And even if it's a little bit today and a little bit tomorrow, you know, you don't worry about it. You just attack it when you can, at your convenience, at your comfort level. Knock off the easy ones. You start working on the harder ones.
So what has all this meant for you now? How do you see what you're going to do tomorrow?
Well, now I lucid dream all the time. And my life is spontaneous now. So I don't really have to plan much anymore. The world is occurring and unfolding for me now. I mean, I always knew this was possible intellectually and from some type of distant memory type thing. I can't really explain that. But the candle that I kept lit my whole life while I was fucking around with the world, you know, I kept it lit for a reason, because I wanted to go back to it someday. So now I am cultivating that candle, and I'm making it brighter and brighter every day.
So do you want to describe your candle?
Yes, it's the recognition that you're two beings. You're not a hopelessly lost single being. You have a perfect partnership with an unseen part of yourself that you're getting to know. It knows you. It knows you, and it loves you because it keeps you alive. It keeps you alive when you go to bed every night and you go to get reborn every morning. It keeps you alive all the time. There's turmoil and battles and raging wars happening in your body all the time, 24/7, 168. So this is always happening all the time, but you're not noticing so much because we're busy with the world. But once you do start to notice, then there's this appreciation that happens. And as much appreciation as you ever have will be matched with the humility that matches that amount of appreciation. Humility isn't something that happens alone. Humility only happens after appreciation. You know, people don't really quite get this, but if they play it back in their head in slow motion, you come home to your house, all your shit's fucking stolen or wrecked or burnt to the fucking ground. Before you get humbled, it's a grand flash of appreciation of what you lost, you had, You knew, but you miss. So, humility follows appreciation. Humility is important because we know it as a measure, but the humility can't happen without appreciation. So you have to try to lean toward how to find appreciation, how to focus on things and look at your life, what you wanted and what you want, what you can do and what you're not going to do. Find out what to appreciate. Just calm yourself, find that space in between your left and right brain. And when your appreciation grows, your humility will grow. And when those two things occur, your heart energy flows into the space between your brains. And it gives you clarity and peace and courage.
So, for someone that wants to pursue the things that you're talking about, where do they start? What do they do? What do I do tomorrow to pursue the goals that you think I should pursue?
Well, the very first thing I had to do was to acknowledge the amazement of my own body. And as I did that, I gained this appreciation followed by humility, which led to the clarity and the peace. So for me personally, it was acknowledging the most grandest amazement of the events taking place within my body and within the surrounding electromagnetic fields that have been measured, energetic fields, we'll call them, around the body. You know, the heart organ itself has been measured at pulsing 110,000 times in a 24-hour period, and it's energetically measured at 60 times more powerful than brain activity. It creates this field around the body, and it actually can be photographed at a different color and frequency combination with every pulse. So it's quite an amazing instrument, and it even has its own neurons set right on the top. There's like a patch of brain neurons that live and grow and maintain around the on top of the heart muscle, the top of it, around 30 to 40,000 neurons. So it's just quite an amazing feat what's going on with the heart. And then the fact that the heart itself does not actually pump. It's not a pump muscle. It's a reactor machine. When the blue blood gets to the door of the heart machine, it opens the door. It lets the blue blood in, and it basically spins it, re-vortexes it, and it sends it out, and it goes on the rest of its journey. So when the fetus is being formed and the woman, it doesn't, the heart forms after the circulatory system, after the bloodstream. So before the heart is formed, you can see the blood pulsing through the baby's fetal body, you know, before the heart is even formed. So the blood system or organ or whatever you want to call it, it is connected to something mysterious, unseen, that hasn't been identified. So the blood is somehow self-organized, self-powered, or linked mysteriously, wirelessly to some other parts of the body or something else. So the blood is intense. And when you look at blood cells, just looking at one single blood cell, there's anywhere from hundreds to thousands of independent, non-connected, floating operational structures inside the cell. And then besides that, you have this huge mechanism of the membrane, which is very multi-parted and multifunctional for the in and out functions of the cell. And then this all is operated by this supreme brain headquarters nucleus, which is extremely mysterious to even the scientists and the people who do the research. So there's an extreme mystery just to one single human cell, the dynamics and the amount of operations that it does and synchronicity and everything. So it's just quite a dynamic presentation to myself. And then all this is tandemed up with the multi-layers of consciousness, and I guess I'll put quotes around the word experience. So like multi-levels of consciousness and experience on top of all this grandness. Lizzo, you know, I could keep talking about it, but like basically I think I've given you a nice wrap-up. So it's so amazing that I used this experience of looking at my body in this way to gain more appreciation, humility, clarity, and peace.
And why has this journey brought you here?
I don't know. I don't know where I'm at exactly. Where are we exactly?
I would say a discussion on a website called Fakeologist, which is its reason for existence is to discuss media fakery.
Well, I studied media fakery real hard my whole life just by exposure, and then I started getting into it as a subject in 2004 after I recovered from the towers going down, which I witnessed pretty close. I was in Philadelphia live when it happened. And
you're saying that you personally saw the towers come down?
And now we have people that worked in New York City in that area at the time, and all of them got to miss the towers coming down. So after years of study, we know exactly
who is we.
My me and Nina are partners. We've been together for 35 years, and her sister and nephews all worked up there.
So you are saying that you witnessed the towers fall down?
No, it wasn't like that. It was like a shared experience, and being so close by in Philly and having people in New York City, it was like a very real, happening, personal experience for all of us.
So you didn't witness the towers come down?
Oh, no. We just saw the how they did finally fall in like 30-second pieces each. Saw that.
How did you see? So you did see them fall down
on TV.
Oh, okay. So you saw something on television, and why was that different from a movie?
Because the it hadn't been made legal yet for American government, federal government, to use propaganda against American people. That wasn't passed until 2012. So at that time, it was illegal for the government to engage in propaganda. So we thought that they were telling the truth on the news.
Okay, but what was it about what you saw in television that was different to a movie?
Oh, only that there was live reporters there saying it was actually happening. There was nothing.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so is it your view that the towers were struck by aircraft?
They were already on schedule to be demolished, those buildings. So they were mostly almost completely empty. The demolition stuff had been set ahead of time, and they also used directed energy weapons to bring them straight down at the end.
Okay.
And there was no plane.
No planes.
No,
and no one was in the tower, in your opinion?
No, I don't think. There might have been some collateral casualties, but if there was any people that died, it was under 100 people.
So there was no... Is it possible that the the television that you saw had been filmed at a previous time, or was in fact just a model, a filming of models collapsing?
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
Hi, this is Kevin. I'm the NirvanaNow.Ninja, and you're listening to Fakeologist Radio on Fakeologist.com.
How's that for a coincidence, Kevin?
Yeah, that's funny.
That is funny. So, yeah, so is it possible that what you saw on television had already been filmed years in advance?
I don't know. Not sure. Okay. Because they did end up clearing that land and putting another building up there.
Yeah. They sure did.
But anyway, the whole thing was really good to show off how doldrummed out the Western spectators are.
Yes, for sure.
It was very good for that, and it woke me up big time because, like, I thought that it was some kind of weird attack on the United States or something like that. So it took me like a year or two to get over that. Yeah. And then when I started doing my conspiracy theory stuff, I was like, wow, this is endless. And it just kept going on and on. So when I got to like 2017, I was like, I have had enough, because it's just, it never ended. You know, I mean, there was like one conspiracy thing, and I was looking at it for like 13 years straight. So I was like, that's cool. I'm done. You know, I don't really need to look at conspiracy theories anymore, because at the same time, I was blending it with my ideas about the heart, the body, spirituality, all the unseen things, actuality versus reality. You know, trying to get to the bottom of our existence seemed more important than getting to the bottom of conspiracy theories, even though it's important to understand how we got here. Like, right now it seems like our existence is very, very, very illusionary. But that doesn't take away from our actuality, whatever that is.
My view that I'd like your comments on is that there is only one conspiracy, and that is a conspiracy between the people, or between Satan and the Creator. What's your view of that idea?
Well, I think it's more likely that God made creation and these personifications, which are life forms, and then the ultimate personification, which is us. Now, we had the power to create. So what looks like malfeasance is actually what we've created. So
so you think, when you say we, you think I'm responsible for creating the towers coming down? Is that what you're saying or not?
No, I think that we each have a little teeny piece, but if we're here witnessing this today, we're all pretty much part of the action. So everybody that's at the table right now is at the table for a fucking reason.
Okay, and what do you think that reason is?
A solution.
Resolution. We're here to resolve something.
Yes.
So my view is that the thing we're here to resolve is to make a decision to be on God's side or on Satan's side. We're choosing one over the other. What's your view of that?
Well, I don't really think that there's any conflicts. So I wouldn't say so much as a conflict as an event. So, you know, what's happening is happening. So the chips are going to fall where they may. And those of us who win will be relegated to observer status. So they won't be big-time players anymore. But those of us who resolve will continue on as big-time players.
So being a big-time player is a disadvantage or an advantage? I can't quite follow that.
Big time players get it all. They get to walk advantaged and disadvantaged and not care about it one way or the other. Resolution means getting to the bottom of something.
Yeah. Okay, so you don't think the resolution is going to be as described in the Bible?
Resolution is going to be solo. This game is for individuals. So everything that's happening is happening. It's real, and it's also not real. But the most real thing is what's happening in your heart and your creation mechanism that you're driving in the base of your brain. You need to, I believe, each person's served best to unify those two energy centers and get to the bottom of their existence.
So do you have... So the guide that I use to try and do that is the Bible. What guide do you try to use? Is it the Sufi thing you were talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I like a lot of the stuff that's in the Bible, and I especially like the word Bible because it literally is showing one of the greatest lessons of our existence, which is this duality format that we're born into and that our bodies seem to be operating in. So just having that as a, well, you know, it's like a temporary baseline. I mean, just because I have a baseline on something as I travel doesn't mean I don't trade that baseline. Like I may need one baseline to get to one level and then I switch to a different baseline to get to the next level. So I don't worry about baselines being be all end alls. Now, I have no be-all, end-alls because it doesn't work that way. There is no be-all, end-all. There is no beginning and no end. It's an event. So
so you're assuming that the biblical model is that there is an end and that we have to make a choice about which side we're going to be on. That's not your view.
Well, I believe that we're walking inside an illusionary package, but there is authenticity inside that. So this is part of the dual being explanation. It's not just one fake or one real. There's more than one way to explain the duality aspect of how we walk. So you know, one of them, yes.
Yeah, doesn't duality imply that there's only two ways to explain things?
Hardly. It explains that's one way to explain things. That's what it explains.
Okay, so I'm just trying to... So I'm... I guess I'm being a bit pushy here. I'm just trying to understand what it is that the resolution is and what model you're using to guide, I guess, your actions, the things you decide to do or not do over
the three words,
as things unfold, if you like.
Yeah, the three words are what cause the peace between the left and the right brain. The three words are do no harm. But in order to even have that as a motive or a goal, there has to be a baseline even for that. So there has to be an acknowledgement of the peace, love, and beauty of the heart itself. And heart matters. So if you can advance yourself to detail that in your mind, then you can go forward from there.
And how do you decide whether your action or inaction does no harm?
Well, we have great examples of that, but you would actually have to do an independent study of your own volition and of your own desire to know that knowledge.
Okay, so how do you go about that?
Well, the way I was able to do it partly was to focus on my impetus or my driving force or simply by acknowledging the wonder of the fact that I'm alive and that there's some driving force mechanism inside me that's causing me to be alive, to be unique, to be this representative of life.
And what do you think that driving force mechanism is?
I'm quite sure that it's the most benevolent, one true creator of of all things that exists in everything.
But you think he's the one driving your bus?
Oh, we're partners. He powers me, I drive.
So, just as a comment, talking to you, I don't get a very clear picture of what you're advising people like me to do. And you know, I don't know if you care about that or not. Whereas I find reading the Bible gives me a very clear, either rightly or wrongly, but the message, the story, I think is very clear. I don't know if you're seeking feedback on what you're saying or not, but if you.
Oh, very much I am, and I very, very much appreciate you opening your heart to me like this. Thank you very much.
Okay. So that I would, I guess, be interested in finding out what you think explicitly, what the things are. Like, you know, for example, the Bible has Jesus saying, behave this way, do these things. I don't get a strong impression from you that you have a similar view. Am I wrong?
No, you're wrong. If I could be as humble and loving as Jesus was, that would be what I would want for myself and any other person.
So you do think then that following Jesus' teaching is the way to resolve our difficulties?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Teachings of Jesus Christ, I don't think I have any issues with it, except maybe they mistranslated some words here or there. But other than that, I do not have any problems at all. I'm totally behind the teachings of Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
There's some doctrines in the Bible and some of the ways things are interpreted by the church leaders. You know, that I just think some of the translations were done purposefully wrong at the 300-year mark. Yeah,
yeah, I couldn't agree. Again, I certainly couldn't agree with you more.
That's cool. Well, I think we have a lot of agreement then, actually.
Yes, it sounds like it. Oh, well, thank you for your time. It's late for me, so I'm going to head off to get some sleep.
Glad that
nice
we caught
to meet
each
you,
other.
Kevin.
Yep. It's glad that we got and the we'll, time. Yeah.
Perhaps we'll assume we'll talk again. Take care.
Bye bye.
That's all, folks.